Kiki rode up front, Evan behind them with Angelina, Raimundo crammed in the far back. They eased off the shoulder of the highway, aiming north for America.
"We was talking about gaydar," Eduardo said. "It's like gay crossed with radar."
Evan said, "You don't say."
"We was playing a driving game, seeing if Special K here has the gaydar, you know, looking at people we pass."
"He's fascinated by this," Kiki said.
"Perhaps too fascinated." From the rear, Raimundo peered forward, head swiveling side to side. It seemed the kind of conversation he'd not been privy to. His arm was draped over the seat back, he and Angelina holding hands.
"And who he thinks is hot, you know," Eduardo said.
"Turns out, it's hard to predict."
He jerked his head to indicate Evan behind him.
"How about Guero Cabron back here? He your type?"
Kiki turned around to assess Evan, mustache sagging as he frowned thoughtfully.
"Nah," he said. "He's just an ordinary guy. Not too handsome."
Once they crossed the border, Angelina asked that they stop at a motel so she could clean up before returning home. They were covered with grime, sweat, and blood. The price of two rooms well worth it, even if she weren't pregnant and in need of a rest after the day's ordeals. In the presence of Angelina, Kiki and Special Ed seemed to have evolved from murderous henchmen to nursemaids, running out to bring them clean clothes. Evan emerged from his room wearing stiff blue Wranglers, rattlesnake boots, a hammered gold oval belt buckle, and a fitted black and gold western shirt with caballero cuffs and embroidered leather yokes. The men waited in the parking lot, leaning against the front of the Jeep, stifling laughter.
"Ese looks like one of them village people," Eduardo said.
Evan scowled and banged on the neighboring room's door.
"Let's get going."
His ribs ached with every inhalation. His forehead still bled sporadically. His wrist was swollen, and he'd be unable to fish the majority of the splinters from the side of his neck until he got home to his surgical tweezers and a magnifying mirror. He knocked again, and Raimundo stuck his head out. He was freshly showered, his dark curls wet, and he looked more handsome than he had any right to be in the same outfit that made Evan look like a gigolo or an extra in a third-rate version of Oklahoma.
"She wants to see you."
"Me?"
"Yes."
Raimundo emerged, gave Special Ed and Kiki a wide berth, and climbed into the rear of the Jeep through the trunk. Evan entered the room. Angelina was lying on the bed, soles planted, knees turned inward, arms crossed at her chest in a hug. Constructive rest pose. She was staring at the ceiling.
"I'm scared,"
Evan said.
"Okay.
How can I face everyone? After what I've done. My papa."
"A lot of people have done a lot worse."
"It doesn't feel that way."
"It never does."
"I don't know what I'll do. Who I'll be."
"Figure out the second, and you'll answer the first," Evan said.
"Then you'll know what you need to apologize for, what you shouldn't apologize for, what responsibilities you should shoulder, and what freedoms you deserve."
"Do you know all that?"
she asked.
"For yourself?"
"No."
"I can't live there anymore," she said. "In Eden."
Evan said,
"Okay."
She looked at him, eyes brimming. Then she took note of his outfit and laughed.
"What have they done to you?"
The more sullen he looked, the more she laughed, and then finally he looked down shyly, shook his head, and gave her the grin she'd been pushing for. She eased out of bed, cradling her stomach with the shelf of her forearm. He held the door for her. They were out in droves. all the people of Eden lining the street of the brief downtown, waving and showing off flowers and signs welcoming Angelina home, standing on sidewalks, holding hands and holding babies. The electronic scoreboard at the high school read, "Rattlers celebrate Angelina Urrea's safe return." Evan had no idea what to make of it. Nothing in his personal history came close to a reference point for an impromptu parade like this. Throngs of folks in front of the coffee shop, the taqueria, hoisting mugs and cups of horchata in toasts. There were Hortensia and Arnulfo, his face mottled purple-yellow with fading bruises. The barbers paused mid-haircut along with their clients, who stood in rippling plastic capes, heads half-shorn, smiling with delight and relief. The two stoplights, mercifully, were green. Angelina waved and waved and made tiny exclamations beneath her breath. She sobbed quietly all the way to her family compound. Evan remembered arriving at these razor-topped walls for the first time 7 days and a lifetime ago. Special Ed had called ahead and made arrangements for Evan. Once they dropped Angelina off at her front step, he'd drive Evan immediately to the airstrip, where Aragon's plane would fly him home. The PMCs had laid the gate open and formed a neat welcoming formation, the jeep rolling through their midst with the mock formality of a honeymoon limousine's departure. The men offered a foil to the townsfolk, courteous, professional, and brisk. The jeep rumbled across the rough terrain, arrived in front of the suburban house with its white picket fence. Evan felt a pull in his chest, a sense of homecoming, though it was not a homecoming for him, or even Angelina. Eduardo parked in front of the little gate. They all got out. The front door of the house was open. Through the screen door, Evan could make out Aragon's and Belicia's shadowy outlines, waiting for their daughter across the threshold. Raimundo said, "I'm gonna wait out here." Special Ed said, "I don't fucking blame you." Angelina stood at the edge of the picture-perfect lawn, gathering herself, hands pressed to her stomach for support or comfort. She moved through the prop of a white gate, heading down the walk to her childhood house. Evan sensed the shadows in the foyer shift, Aragon's arm moving across Belicia's shoulders, Belicia curling into his side. Angelina got a few steps further, then hesitated. She looked back. Then she was running toward them. No, toward Evan. She threw her arms around his neck, buried her face in his shoulder, and squeezed him hard. He held her. It felt natural. He sensed a kind of longing he was unfamiliar with, a desire to stay here in this place, to freeze this moment in time before everything blew open once more into countless complications. She was a child and a soon-to-be mother at the same time, and she held him with a kind of familial need and gratitude that he'd never known outside of Joey. The screen door creaked open to receive her. Angelina tore herself away from Evan and walked to her house. This time, she didn't look back. While the pilot ran a few last-minute checks on the Cirrus Vision jet, Evan waited outside and breathed the arid South Texas air, tasting mesquite and sage. He'd cuffed his sleeves and untucked the shirt and felt slightly less ridiculous in the cowboy wear. The pilot called over to him, and Evan started to board when he heard a horn bleating. Aragon commanding the jeep, flying toward them. He hopped out, meeting Evan at the bottom of the unfolded air stair. He set his hands on Evan's shoulders and regarded him. Evan regarded him right back. Those big, noble features, thick, dark hair threaded with gray. And his eyes, warm and alive and textured with the things he'd seen and done. It was incredibly intimate,
the act of looking into another man's eyes.
Senor Nowhere Man,
Aragorn said,
no one measures up to a myth. But you come close.
Remember, Evan said, she's not perfect. She's a kid.
None of us are perfect, Aragorn said. You and I, least of all.
Can you make it right?
I have to.
Aragorn extended his hand.
Until next time.
Evan stared at his proffered hand.
Are we...
He caught himself, unsure of what he wanted to ask.
Yes, Aragorn said, I will be your friend, and you will be mine.
He took Evan's hand, pulled him into a one-armed embrace. It made Evan's broken ribs sing with pain. But somehow he didn't mind. They pulled away, Aragorn taking him in with a final look. He nodded at the plane.
Keep the window shades open, he said. Enjoy the view.
Then he walked away, back to the truck, his family, the many large and small wrongs he had to set right. Evan boarded the plane alone. Chapter 60. The Smashed White Gumdrop. After setting down at the private airport in Santa Monica, Evan walked a mile and a half to where he'd left his own Ford F-150 in the last West Side residential neighborhood that didn't require parking permits. Grateful for the spare clothes he kept in the truck vaults, he changed out of his mariachi costume. If he showed up to his next stop in that outfit, he'd never hear the end of it. He did not drive home. Instead, he drove to Westwood, found the apartment building, went straight to the second floor, and knocked. She answered. Same glum expression, flannel shirt over her worn Hello Kitty with an AK-47 t-shirt, a slightly more feminine version of the cargo pants he wore. She scanned him. He felt the trickle down his cheek and realized that the gash in his forehead had opened up again. His neck was glistening, the embedded shrapnel giving off a silvery burn. He was hunched to the side, protecting the broken rib, his left hand pronated to relieve pressure until he could get the wrist wrapped. For once, she had no ready remark. Her expression migrated to concern. He read in her face that she understood that his coming home, his coming here, meant that the mission was over. She stepped back, opening the door. He hobbled in, bone-tired. Climbing the stairs had cost him a bit. It took some effort for him to lower himself to sit against the wall next to the dog bed. Sensing the seriousness of the situation, Dog the dog lifted his head, gave him a nuzzle, and then returned to his croissant-shaped slumber. Joey plopped down in the gamer chair inside her workstation. She felt safe in there, protected. She faced him through the gap in the circular desk. He said, "What do you want me to understand?" She pulled a red vine from the ever-present bucket and chewed off a length, skipping her front teeth and going straight to her molars, washed it down with Dr. Pepper, flipped her hair over to show off that shaved strip on the right side. The emerald of her eyes, brighter than usual, seemed to be burning. She said,
"Really?
Really." She chewed some more, thought about it, gathering herself. Then,
"When I went into the system, I had nothing, right? You know that kind of nothing. Like, not one pair of socks without a hole, nothing. Like, no soap for your shower, nothing. And people, grown-ups mostly, but kids too, just treated you however, used you. And this one year, a week after Christmas, someone from a church dropped off a gingerbread house. It was all stale, right? And the kids? We got to choose one piece to break off and eat. But it went by age.
And I was the youngest, new in the house, the last stained cot in the corner. And so I chose last. And all that was left was the smashed white gumdrop. And it sucked. It fucking sucked. The one thing we had to look forward to in like a year, and I got the worst piece. Didn't even have any flavor. And anything else that came up, like ever, I never picked first. No one ever picked me first. I was never special. I never got to just... Fuck. Fuck! Do what I wanted to do. Getting pulled out for the program. Going to Switzerland. Even coming here. All of it. I never chose any of it. And now all I want to do is go on a road trip with my big, badass lion-hunting dog, and I am trained in more martial arts than I can name, and rapists, like, they walk fast and don't turn around when I'm behind them in an alley. And I'm capable, X. I'm capable. And I'm special. I am. And I want to do this so bad. But I can't do it if you'll be mad at me. I'll just feel so awful and guilty. But if I stay, I'll feel so awful and resentful, and I don't know what to do. But I know I can do this, if you'll let me. No, if you happily let me. I can take care of myself. I'm special, X. I'm special, okay? I am special. And I'm worth it. She finally stopped, rocking forward in her chair, smearing at her cheeks with the heels of her hands. You're right, Evan said. She looked up distrustfully, her tiny voice, the one that broke his heart a dozen different ways. I am? Yeah, he said. Every single way. You're worth it. She lowered her face into her palms and wept. Chapter 61. Fuck it. Evan stopped at the pet store on his way home. It stank of birds and stagnant fish tanks. He found the section in the back where aquarium pebbles hung on metal prongs, arranged by color. He picked a packet of soothing cobalt blue, got halfway to checkout, then went back. With a sigh, he put the packet back and chose rainbow instead. Riding next to Loralee on the elevator, Evan tried to straighten up so as not to draw attention to his broken rib. He stayed in the corner, hiding the slivers studding the side of his neck and pretending to scratch his forehead with his functional hand to hide the gash. Prattling on about a recent failed date, Loralee stopped with a punctuating exhalation. When Evan didn't inquire, she gave another pained moan, this one slightly louder. What? He finally asked flatly. It's just been so much, she said. I've been holding a lot of stress in my shoulders. Evan said, me too. The penthouse was suffused with the golden hues of Angelino dusk, which turned every surface gold-plated. The front door sealed behind him with a weighty thump, the silence wrapping itself around him. No smell of migas, no audience with a padrino in the living room, no pregnant young woman requiring care. No Joey. His walls of glass didn't look west, but the sunset colored the visible sky, bruised mauve, the color of the underskirts of a Toulouse-Lautrec whore. Evan walked over to Vera 3, where she rested on the kitchen island, unmoored in her salad bowl, pulled the packet of glass pebbles from his pocket, and spilled them in around her. A rainbow array. All the everything. He set her upright with great care.
You and me, he said.
She looked underwhelmed. The living wall had sprouted its first signs of life, seedlings pushing out like fine hairs. That pleased him. No one had answered his knock at 12B. He assumed that Mia had taken Peter out for one of their evening drives along PCH. Imagining her on the surgeon's table left him with a feeling of helplessness, unmatched since childhood. His skills were useless. No amount of planning or sacrifice would make any difference. It would all come down to fate and the scalpel.
Evan stared at the freezer room and its rows of vodka bottles. All anyone had talked about this whole damn mission was alcohol, and he was sick of it.
He turned away, moving through the great room, padding toward the hall. Paused in a draft of air conditioning, the disco ball hanging overhead. There was a light switch on the wall at his side. He clicked it. The disco ball spun into motion, throwing jewels every which way, bringing the hard surfaces to life with dizzying motion. At his feet lay the Velcro suits that Joey and Peter had sloughed off. He studied them for a moment, then picked up the biggest one, loosened the straps, and donned it. He felt absurd. More absurd than he had wearing the cowboy getup the special boys had foisted on him. But he stood there in the puffy suit, glittering lights playing across him. His rib hurt like hell, and he had a headache. But he decided, fuck it. He took a two-step running start and flung himself at the wall sideways in a half flip. He smacked the wall and stuck, head lower than his feet, his body like an accent mark. The pain subsided with a few breaths, and he hung there, velcroed onto the wall, staring out at the dying light of day from an entirely different vantage. It was glorious.
Chapter 62 Until The waiting room at the surgical suite was filled with a dozen weary souls, gray faces and bitten nails. Mia was there, wan and exhausted, along with Peter, Uncle Wally, and Aunt Janet, who had inexplicably brought a picnic basket, though it was 6 a.m. Mia looked awful, eyes swollen with sleeplessness, her hair stiff and brittle. In anticipation of the surgery, she'd had to lather her locks with antibacterial shampoo, which had washed the life right out of them. The small crew had commandeered a corner of the waiting room, Evan sitting among them as if he belonged. Mia had retreated within herself. Peter was listless at Evan's side, Wally barely holding himself together. Janet kept up a stream of perky chatter, despite the fact that no one else was participating. A half hour in, Joey showed up with a gas station bouquet of flowers. Only a miracle or a tragedy could drag her out of bed this early, and Evan wasn't sure which this would prove to be. She gave the sunflowers to Mia, wished her the best, said her hellos, then signaled to Evan that she wanted her to get going. Joey was jittery. She'd hated hospitals ever since her aunt, who was like a mother to her, her mant, had died when she was young. "Walk me out?" Evan nodded. Before going, Joey crouched before Peter and placed her hands on his knees. Even now, Peter perked up. Joey was a source of endless fascination to him.
"I hate hospitals," he told her. "My dad was in the hospital before."
"Hospitals are also where people go to get well," Joey said.
Peter appeared unconvinced. Joey looked down, bit her lip, searching for words.
"I didn't have much family growing up," she said quietly, "unlike you."
but I had a aunt who I loved very much. And you know what she used to tell me?
What?
That I was one of the magical people. And she knew, because she always did. And I want to tell you something, Peter. You're one of the magical people, too.
He brightened, blinking back his delight, then hugged her around her neck.
Joey started out, Evan at her side down the hall. Evan said, "What about me?"
"You?" Joey said.
"Definitely not one of the magical people." She made a fist, pressed it into his shoulder, and pushed him off balance. Then she grinned. She'd bought a new truck, the Ford P-758, which looked like Evan's F-150 if someone had put it through the dryer and shrunk it down. The back was loaded up, passenger window down. Dog the dog's big head stuck out, tongue lolling, big smile.
Evan halted. "You're leaving straight from here?"
"Yep."
"Still don't know where you're going?"
"Nope."
They stared at each other awkwardly.
"Welp," she said. "Bye."
"Bye."
He started away. "Wait." He turned.
"Okay. Fine," she said. "I'll let you give me one piece of advice."
"I didn't ask."
"Yeah, but you know you want to."
He considered. "When you come into a situation, don't want anything. Don't want approval. Don't want to scare people. Don't want anyone to like you. Don't need to prove anything to them or make them angry. Then you can see what's really happening."
She scooped her hair behind her ears, nodded nervously, then nodded again.
"Okay. Right. And if I need you, I can always call 1-855-2-NOWHERE.
Evan said, "It's not a helpline."
"Shut up," she said.
"It is for me."
She was still grinning when she pulled out. At 7 o'clock, a nurse arrived to give Mia a 5-minute warning before taking her back for prep. She received the news stoically, Evan, Janet, and Peter looking on. Wally had already hit his limit.
"Listen," he said after the nurse withdrew, "it's an 8-hour surgery and I don't want to wait here. I mean," tears were running down his face, which he and everyone else pretended to ignore. "I'll just be in the cafeteria, reviewing my cases."
Peter had stopped talking, smashing his flattened hands together between his knees. "I understand," Mia said, planting a kiss on Wally's cheek.
"I'll stay with Peter,"
Janet said. Wally lumbered out, head lowered, shoulders shaking. Evan squatted before Mia, rested his hands on her knees. She remained deep inside herself, curled on the seat, breathing. After a few minutes, the nurse came up at their side and waited patiently to take Mia back. Mia looked at Evan.
"Remember what we talked about?"
He said,
"I will. I just have to get on the table.
Let them put the needle in my arm."
"That's it,"
Evan said.
"See you on the other side.
Janet will call you when it's over."
He noted that she didn't say that she herself would call when it was over. The nurse led Mia back. Evan ruffled Peter's hair and started out. Halfway down the hall, he heard the pounding of tiny footsteps.
"Evan Smoke!"
He turned around. Peter was standing there, angry little face, fists clenched at his sides. Evan's throat was dry. He swallowed. He said,
"Do you need my help?"
Peter's face was fighting with itself. He forced out words.
"A girl in my class. She had cancer. Her hair fell out. And then she left school and she didn't come back again."
Evan just looked at him.
I don't want to talk about it,
Peter said. Evan said, okay.
I want to see my mom in there, before she goes in. And Uncle Wally's all, like, too sad and doesn't want to cry in front of me. And Aunt Janet talks too much. So,
Evan waited.
Will you go in with me?
Evan said, yes.
They walked back to the waiting room. Janet had buried herself in the picnic basket. She popped up as if emerging from a burrow.
Oh, I was just going to run down and check on Wally. Ask the nice lady at the desk. She said she'd take you both in.
Evan went over with Peter and asked the nice lady. She led them in. Mia was in a curtained section in pre-op, already in a gown, her unruly hair pushed back, the surgeon's initials written in magic marker on the left side of her forehead at the hairline. Without hesitating, Peter climbed into the hospital bed and curled into her.
Hi, Mama. Hi, little man.
She stroked his hair. Look, it's obvious I'm your biggest fan, right?
The thing is, it's not because of how you act, or what you do, or what your grades are, okay?
His face was below her chin, and she turned away so he wouldn't see the tears dotting her gown.
I don't care what you do. It's who you are that I love, that I'm proud of. And no matter what happens,
a hitch in her voice, but she caught it. When you grow up, you don't ever have to be sad that I didn't know how spectacular you turned out. I already do. I already know how amazing you were in high school and in college, and how great your girlfriend is. Or boyfriend.
Mom,
Peter said. But he was crying.
And your job.
And your kids.
How wonderful they are, too. I know it all already. Okay? Okay, Mama.
I need you to know that I see you fully. And that means everything you will ever be.
I see that, too. All of it.
She closed her eyes, tears leaking, and kissed the top of his head, breathing in his scent deep. She let go. Peter slid off the bed, walked back out to the waiting area, Evan trailing him. Peter hopped up onto a cushioned chair. Evan sat beside him. They stared at the electronic board showing patient ID numbers and status.
How long can we stay?
Peter asked. How long do you want to stay?
Until,
Peter said. Evan gave a nod. On the electronic board, Mia's ID number moved from one column to the next. Peter's breathing quickened a bit. Evan reached over, turned his hand palm up, and set it on the armrest between them. Peter took it. Epilogue: The Hunt for X. Victoria Donahue Carr was two-thirds into her morning swim when she sensed the vibration of footsteps along the tile. The indoor pool had been installed in the West Terrace in 1933 by Roosevelt so he could exercise his polio-riddled muscles. With its arched ceiling, decadent rows of elevated half-moon windows, and scenic murals of Caribbean sailboats commissioned by JFK, it had an old-world grandeur that helped motivate her morning workouts. Disused since Tricky Dick had drained it to make room for press briefings, it had languished until she'd restored it to its former glory. One of the many updates to the White House that had required a woman's touch. She finished breaststroking to the wall, pulled herself up, and snapped off her goggles. She hated to be disturbed here. It always meant bad news. Her dread intensified when she saw the woman waiting patiently at the end, arms crossed. Special Agent in Charge Naomi Templeton, the closest thing to a personal liaison Victoria had in the Secret Service. Templeton wore an ill-fitting suit, her large shoulders barely constrained by the fabric. Her blonde hair was cut bluntly, as always, a strip mall haircut that seemed to complement her tough, handsome features. She was one of those women, Victoria had always thought, who was one makeover away from being a jaw-dropper. "I'm sorry to disturb you, Madam President." "No," Victoria said, "you're not." "I suppose I'm not." "It is about him."
"I see.
Remember when I briefed you about that massacre at the cartel estate in Guaridon? The one that bore his fingerprints?" "You mean the one that violated the terms of his pardon?" "The very one. We've turned up our surveillance efforts. I got an alert from NSA 45 minutes ago. Facial recognition was scrambled. He seems to have some kind of sartorial camouflage that disguises the nodal points." "Did you say sartorial camouflage?" "I'm afraid I did. As I said, we don't have a clear facial image, but we hit the cherries on biometric gait recognition for someone entering the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center yesterday."
"Medical Center? Is he ill?"
"We're unsure what he was there for. We are looking into patient records, hitting the obvious complications." Victoria leaned back, let the water ripple around her, hoping she would find it soothing.
"How sure are you?"
97.143%. That was a very Naomi Templeton answer.
"So it's back on then,"
Victoria said. "The hunt for X." Naomi gave a curt nod.
"Very well then," Victoria said. "Take him down."
She sank back into the water, stayed under until the watery shape of Naomi Templeton receded. The president kicked off the wall and continued her workout.
Somehow, it felt less relaxing than before.
Please keep listening to hear a bonus audio feature with authors Greg Hurwitz and Jack Carr.
I'm Jack Carr, New York Times bestselling author of the Terminal List series.
And I'm Greg Hurwitz, New York Times bestselling author of the Orphan X series. And Jack and I are here to talk a bit about the writing process and what it takes to write thrillers and how we do it. So I'm looking forward to the chat.
Oh, me too. This is so awesome. Thank you so much for inviting me to do this.
So listen, the first thing I wanted to talk to you about is your research. You know, we call it research. You call it, you know, your life, because that's where you came out of, right? It's so compelling. There's so much ground truth. There's so much telling detail. And I was just wondering, what do you do to stay on top of that? And obviously now you're not an active duty practicing SEAL. How do you keep your skills up? How do you keep up with the technology?
Well, a lot of that is getting to the range, going to train with people that I used to train with in the past. But I was lucky for the first book in that it took place in areas where I'd already been. So I'd been to Iraq, I'd been to Afghanistan, all the places in the United States that I write about in the book, I'd already been, because this is the last year of my time on active duty. So I'm in my 20th year, I'm getting ready to get out of the military, move into that next chapter in life. And I couldn't just be zipping around the country or the world doing this research. So
yeah, with your Underwood,
he's couldn't like do it. Exactly.
Green zone typing away.
Yeah. None of that. And then, I could look back on those times and write the novel based on past experience. Now with the second one, True Believer, then I went down, I had to right away go to Mozambique. So I retired from the military in 2016. I hadn't even submitted the first novel to Simon and Schuster yet, but I always knew because of that story of John Grisham writing A Time to Kill first, not being able to give that thing away, and then writing The Firm. And then, of course, that takes off, and it's the movie with Tom Cruise, and then they go back, and A Time to Kill, reprint that, and make the movie with Matthew McConaughey. But I always knew that I would write two novels because of that in particular. And so I was already on a plane to Mozambique before I submitted that first novel, and doing research on the ground, in Mozambique, taking pictures of rocks and the dirt and trees and talking to the professional trackers or the trackers and the professional hunters and just taking notes and taking that and then applying it to the story. So, then for the third one, once again, Savage Sun, I have to go downrange again. South Africa helped training up an anti-poaching unit out there. They were switching over to M4s and Glocks, which are two weapon systems that I have some experience with. And so I went down there and I learned so much from these guys. And a lot of them had grown up, of course, tracking animals to feed their families. Then they caught the tail end of the bush wars. These guys were a little older, caught the tail end of the bush wars. So now they took that animal tracking, applied it to humans. And yeah. then after that, they came back and essentially you had all these unemployed war veterans in South Africa. So the South African National Police were formed and they brought these guys into the fold to then take that tracking expertise and apply it to an urban environment, now getting much more into the psychology of tracking. And then they kind of aged out of that. And so they've been picked up by a lot of these private concessions that are protecting some of the last rhino on Earth. So I learned so much from these guys and got to apply it. I was still editing the second novel at the time. So I got to apply some of it to that one, some of it to the next novel. And then for that third one as well, I went to Kamchatka Peninsula, Russia, because there was so much that happened in that area and I hadn't been there before. So I had to go put boots on the ground. So the research is so important to my novels because you get that local flavor that you can't really get unless you go there. And I got very lucky with the last one with The Devil's Hand because it's mostly continental United States based and the research was mostly academic into bioweapons and biomedical research and that sort of a thing. So I got very fortunate that I didn't need to go somewhere to do that. And then for this last one, the one I'm in right now, it's really wanted to go to Israel. But then Israel was open, then it was closed, and it was open, then it was closed, and it got a little crazy as far as trying to figure out how to get there. So I didn't make it. So I'll have to revisit Israel in a future novel.
You know, it's funny. One of the things that occurs to me is most writers who I talk to who are successful, and it's true for anything in any field, it's the focus is on doing the work. And it's like, you finished that first book, you hadn't even sold it. And already you're flying to research the next one. It's like when there's the commitment to the craft, to the job itself, everything tends to take care of itself downstream. Right. But if you were all like focused on agents and sales and marketing and all that, it's like you do the work, you put in the work, you do the research, you make really smart strategic business choices, and then you move on. It's like, you want to always, it just sounds like you're living in the space of the stuff that you love, right? It's the research, it's the plotting, it's the writing. And I think it's one of the reasons why you have had such a meteoric rise, you know? It's cool to hear about that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that part of that, because people get a snapshot oftentimes and they see social media presence or they see you on Joe Rogan or they see you on whatever else. And they think that that's just that all of a sudden just happened. So what I try to tell people is, no, you need to do that work. You need to have that product at its base. Right. It doesn't matter if how many shows you go on or how many followers you have on social media or whatever else. If you don't have that product that is already complete in the case of fiction, in the thriller world, and it is the best product it can possibly be. So I tell people, don't worry about agents, don't worry about publishers, don't worry about your Facebook account, don't worry about any of that. Worry about making the novel the best that it can possibly be. And once you get it as good as you can possibly get it, and there's a line there, because you can spend the next 50 years making it better by one degree. But when you get it to that stage where you are like, hey, if I spent the next 50 years on this, it would get better by a degree. That's the time to start thinking about agents and going to Thriller Fest. I've heard a lot of people that have sat down with these agents at Thriller Fest and these different writing conferences and had that 5-minute kind of speed dating with agents and have it work out for them. Then start doing those sorts of things. But first,
that's not all about sitting around and drinking fancy coffee with honey in it.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And it remains true to this day is that right before we jumped on this, what was I doing? I was typing away, looking at research on one computer, typing away on my other computer that's designated only for writing and doing that work because the books have to be the best they can possibly be.
That's right. That's right. So if you were going to go back and look at the writers who meant a lot to you, who really influenced you and who are kind of been your North Star through this process? Who would you say? Who are three people you'd name?
So I'm very fortunate that my mom was a librarian. So I grew up surrounded with books and a love of reading, and was introduced to authors like Tom Clancy, Nelson DeMille, David Morrell, Stephen Hunter, H.G. Pollack, Mark Olden, Louis L'Amour, all these guys, really a lot of them in the 80s and early 90s who had protagonists with backgrounds I wanted in real life one day. Because back then, a lot of those protagonists, they were Navy SEALs from Vietnam. They were Army Special Forces from Vietnam. They were Marine snipers from Vietnam. They were a CIA operative of some sort in Vietnam. And so I naturally gravitated to those kind of books. And these are the masters whose names we all know today. And some of them continue to hit the New York Times bestseller list every time they have something come out. And so I grew up with these guys really as my mentors and my professors in the art of storytelling. And then I also got very fortunate in that my mom introduced me to Joseph Campbell through a series of interviews he did in 1988 with Bill Moyers called The Power of Myth. And I found out about the hero's journey. I found out about Hero with a Thousand Faces. And really ever since then, I applied what I learned from Hero with a Thousand Faces to the books I read, to the comic books I looked through, to the TV shows I watched, to the movies I watched. And I just, it just became really a part of me at that early age. So he was very influential. All those authors that I talked about, extremely influential, especially David Morrell with Brotherhood of the Rose, Nelson DeMille with The Charm School. These guys were just incredible. And I still have all their books. And now I'm collecting the hardcover edition signed. I'm clueing around collecting those.
That's cool.
Because the ones that I was growing up were mostly the paperbacks. And then reading Herman Woke and Winds of War, War and Remembrance, Caine Mutiny, Ayn Rand's Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged. And then there's one by Anton Meyer called Once an Eagle, which is historical fiction. And it's really a case study in leadership. But it's those are probably the most influential books and authors that have impacted my life.
Excellent. Excellent. And so, listen, we're on this talk in part because it's for audiobooks, right? And, you know, it's a different art form. I always say that, you know, I'm a storyteller first and foremost. I don't care if people read, you know, ebooks, if they read paper books, if they listen to audiobooks, which have had explosive growth. Like I deal stories. I don't care if you snort them or inject them. I just want to get them into your system. But with audiobooks, there's a different level of interface, creative interface, right, with a narrator who's interpreting it. And I was wondering what you think your audio narrator brings. Like, what sort of embellishment does that creative overlay bring to the stories?
Well, I got a little lucky in this respect because I got Ray Porter to read my books, and your audiobook narrator and mine are two of the top guys in the business. And I didn't know that going in because I'm a physical book reader. I had been my entire life. And so I didn't know that these different narrators bring a fan base with them from project to project. That wasn't even a part of my calculus whatsoever. And I got a call from Simon & Schuster on a Friday afternoon, and they said, "Hey, who do you want to read your audiobook? How's this guy?" And it was someone who I don't remember, but I listened to it and I thought, that doesn't sound quite right. And I wrote back because I'm brand new and I don't have a single book out, not one book sold yet. And I said, "Well, can we find somebody else?" And they said, "Yeah, just let us know by the end of the day." And I look at my watch. It's like, and as you know, in publishing, they take their weekends very seriously. Weekends and holidays very seriously in New York publishing industry. So I start listening to a bunch of samples and on audiobooks. And I'm like, okay. And I found Ray Porter. And I heard this voice, and then I started listening to some other samples from other work that he'd done. And I said, this is the guy. So, and I had no idea who he was, no idea his fan base, no idea he was one of these top couple guys in the audiobook narration industry. And I sent it to Simon & Schuster and said, "Hey, Ray Porter, he sounds good." And they said, "Well, we can ask." And they asked, and he said, yes. And he brought this entire fan base to the books. And now I think of his voice. And when I'm writing, just the other day, I thought, oh, I got to this part and I thought, oh, he's not going to know how to pronounce this. And so I made another note to let him know, because now we're friends. Hey, make sure when you get to this, don't spell it out. You say this. It's like Combat Support Hospital or something. And it's called CASH. But you wouldn't know that just by looking at it. So I do think of it in those terms as well. And I got to meet your narrator at a conference not too long ago where we met in person. What a fantastic guy. And they do bring so much to it. And they bring readers from other projects to your books. So they have a huge impact. And I think audiobooks are the fastest growing segment of publishing.
They're huge.
It's amazing.
And so when you work with Ray, so one of your better known fans, Chris Pratt, who's a big fan of your work and maybe embodying some of this soon on Netflix, right?
It's on Amazon Prime. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, Amazon Prime, not Netflix. That's right. And so he described Lieutenant Commander James Reese as one rowdy motherfucker.
Yep.
How does that get conveyed by Ray Porter? How does he embody that like grit, growl, muscularity, but also well-roundedness, right? How do you feel like he manages to bring that aspect of toughness and rowdiness to life?
Yeah, because he's an actor first and foremost, and him traditionally trained and Shakespearean actor, and he's so fantastic. And I think all these narrators do it a little differently, but he doesn't read the whole book first and then go back and do it as a recording. He experiences it as a reader for the first time as he's narrating it. And he might skim it a tiny bit, but that's how he kicks these things off. So I think for him, the way he does it, like you're experiencing it, you feel that you're reading it for the first time because he's reading it essentially for the first time as he's acting it out. And really that's what he's doing. He's an actor first and foremost, and he's creating these essentially a lot of the backgrounds, these accents, the intonations, everything else, and make these characters who they are and come alive just through his voice. So it's this art form that's so fascinating to me. And one of the reasons I don't read my own audiobook is because Ray is so good at it.
That's right.
He's such a professional and such a great guy, such a great human being, so caring. And he can bring his humanity to the project and just bring it alive for the listener.
Is there anything from the narration now listening to the audiobooks that loops back and you think about when you're writing? Like, does the audiobook have any feedback loop back into how you're envisioning scenes and tackling them?
It does, because I think of how difficult I'm making this on my on my narrator if I start off a chapter, a paragraph, whatever it might be, and get into some dialogue. And then, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines in, then I mention that the person has a French accent or something like that. So I do think of it in those more technical terms, but more I'm just excited to hear how Ray interprets this. But I do think of it as far as not tripping him up, making his job a little easier as far as describing how people sound, maybe. And I didn't think about that for the first one, and maybe not even for the second, but now I do.
Yeah, it's in your world building mm-hmm. brain. So what's something people might not know about Reese that you could share, like an unknown aspect of him?
So this one is, so the book I'm working on right now is called In the Blood. And it'll be the fifth novel in the James Reese Terminalist series. And in that book, that's where people are going to learn some things that they haven't discovered quite yet. And that's where my head is right now, because not 15 minutes ago, I was typing some of them out in the story. So
don't give them away.
Yeah, I don't want to give them away. In the Blood.
Wait, I want to buy it and read it.
Oh, so awesome.
So last question for you is, what do you think Reese would think of Orphan X, of Evan Smoke? Do you think those guys would get along well?
I think they would team up. Absolutely. And I think they would definitely have a lot in common and could team up for sure and be quite the force.
They'd share a vodka, a high end.
That's right.
Expensive vodka.
That's right. Your guy likes the vodka.
Well, cool, man. Thanks for giving a bit of a tour into the world, and especially how the audiobook threads in. That's interesting stuff.
Absolutely.
One of the things I like, as you and I've talked about, we have some friends in common. I have a good number of friends who are Navy SEALs. And one of the things that I like and admire so much about your crew is that a lot of you are really Renaissance men. Like, that's one of the really cool things where, there's been parties where it's like, foreign languages and cultures and like really sophisticated aspects of different, like, geopolitical dynamics, right? Geography. Even I had a really funny conversations with one of my friends who's like a fairly esteemed photographer, was talking about like the lenses he uses. And he's talking to one of my buddies who's a demolition breacher, was talking about all the sniper lenses. Like, there's so much overlap. And so it's very interesting to me seeing how you've written and how you've talked about all these influences that you bring in are from such a full range. People sometimes can have a tendency to view SEALs as being more like unidimensional alpha dogs. And there's so much in it. There's so much grasp of culture and psychology and psyops and toughness and nuance and having to know the etiquette of all these different countries. And I find it's really cool having you work in this field that I've worked in and that I love, because it brings such a an amazing sort of renaissance well-roundedness to the story. So it's a cool part of it, man. I'm glad you're in the game.
Oh, thank you so much, man. Other than being a SEAL is what I wanted to do my entire life. And having been in that realm for so long, doing those 20 years, obviously I know the humanity behind these different people. We are human. And, you know, back in, let's say, the 70s or the 80s, if you had a character that was a SEAL or Army Special Forces or something, maybe you could track somebody down and talk to, or maybe you had a friend who had a friend that jumped on a phone call with you and you did a little research. One out of thousands of people that's your research for that person then. And you are taking what that person said and you're translating it through whatever filters that you have, whatever biases you have, whatever preconceived notions you have, and then applying it to a fictional narrative. Mm-hmm. So there was a few things I think lost in translation there. And as people as we've maybe evolved or maybe regressed through social media and having so many different touch points with people of all these different backgrounds now that are sharing their journeys as they leave military service or leave government service or whatever it may be, you're seeing a little more of that humanity. And so now you have some more touch points and people expect that authenticity. They can double check you. They can fact check you. You couldn't have fact checked somebody back in 1982. Yeah. If they had said it, you're like, well, I guess Nelson DeMille did his research and that's all you have. But now you can fact check. So, and people expect that authenticity, especially coming from someone who lived that life for so long. But it allows me to add some more dimensions to my characters and then to the other characters in the story as well.
Cool.
Yeah, man. All right. I'm going to ask you some questions now for this audiobook for Dark Horse right here. So people are getting this with your latest Orphan X novel. And I'm going to talk to you more about that on the podcast we're going to continue to do after this. So for people that want to hear more about you and your writing journey and everything else you've done, which is absolutely incredible, they can listen to that Danger Close podcast. But for this specifically, what made you want to become a writer? How did you get to this stage?
You know, it's weird. So my parents did not allow me to watch television growing up. It was that generation of like the plug-in drug and it was going to rot your brain. And so all day, you know, I was out playing sports. I, you know, played soccer from the time I was in diapers. And I just went to the library. Like I lived in the library, much like you. I went twice a week. I'd, you know, take a stack of books home. I remember having my hands in a basket and my chin on the one on top and, you know, went through all the Hardy Boys, all the Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators. And by fifth grade was reading, you know, obsessed with Stephen King and Peter Benchley. And it's the only way that my brain ever worked. Like I thought in stories. It's the only thing I ever wanted to do. My mom says like, I used to go to bed when I was a kid with like the picture dictionary. I mean, I just loved it. And the other thing I thought was that anyone who loved books, my sister reads even more than I do. She's an incredible reader. And I remember one time when I was in like fourth grade, I was asking him like, well, when are you going to write your first book? Like, I just thought that anybody who likes stories would have to want to write them. And it's so weird. Like we're such different creatures, right? There's so many people think in so many different ways for their professions. It's not like you just choose one. I think you got to have some factory issued software in you in some ways, you know? And so it's the only way literally I ever thought. I mean, I was writing illustrated stories, mysteries when I was in elementary school. And there was one distinct moment. I still remember reading Stephen King. I was reading Salem's Lot, you know, under the bed with like a flashlight. My parents were out. I was terrified. I was 26 years old. No, I was in fifth grade. And I just remember thinking like, how does this guy from across the country and across a decade put together, you know, these familiar words in an unfamiliar way to elicit this much emotion in me. Mm-hmm. Like what a magic that is. He's like, he's a wizard, you know? And I just thought how much I want to do that and emulate that. The way that I felt when I read it was like, in some ways it was my happiest time. And to be able to like live in that the majority of my waking hours is such a delight for me. And so I just love it's, I like wake up in the morning and like roll down the hall to my office on a wave of gratitude. Like I love this job. I can't believe I get paid to do it, you know?
Oh, I do. And it's interesting that you mentioned fifth grade because that was a turning point for me too. In that I'd always been a reader, but at fifth grade, that's when I transitioned from that young adult type reading into what my parents were reading. And that's the year that Hunt for Red October came out by Tom Clancy. Right. And then I just started discovering all these other authors, some through movies like David Morrell through First Blood and then finding Brotherhood of the Rose and
sneaking into my parents. My parents had like Clan of the Cave Bear.
Yes,
like
Clan of the Cave Bear. Like, exactly. It was the era
like
of
trying to find all the sex scenes in that to be like, wait a minute, like what's going on? Like, and so that's no good if you're in fifth grade having like, you know, Neanderthal intercourse setting like a part of your worldview, but
oh yeah,
look, everything's up for grabs. You know, Stephen King was wild. Some of the stuff that he did, he was crazy.
Yeah, but it's interesting also that you mentioned the magic of it, because when I think about what I'm doing now, it is trying to capture some of those memories and that magic that I have. I remember being in a hammock at our cabin, reading a J.C. Pollock book or David Morrell book under those trees. And it was such a magical time in life. And it was so nice not to have an internet, and we didn't have a TV at the cabin. My mom wanted to throw out our TV at home during that same era. And my dad said, absolutely not, because it's sports. He needed to watch his football. So that's the only reason.
So same thing. I was allowed to watch the Boston Red Sox. My dad's from Boston. So that's religion. And I was allowed to watch Hitchcock movies. I always say, like, if you add bourbon, that explains like 90% of my personality, like just right there. But I think our moms were talking to each other.
They might have been. It was an interesting era. And the Clan of the Cave Bear, I distinctly remember that that as well. So we're fortunate to have so many fans that love the characters that we create and really identify with them. And there's so many amazing characters in Orphan X. When you write for them, who do you hear as their voice? Do you hear an audiobook narrator now, or has it morphed over time from the first novels up to now? How does that, who do you hear as you're writing?
It's weird. People ask me this sometimes if I'm casting for a movie, like, did you write it with a movie star in mind? And I never am. I have my own version, and I have, they have their own faces and energy. It's not specific. Like, I couldn't sit down and draw them, but there's like an embodied voice and person and tone that I hear in my head. And what's amazing is that Scott Brick, who's my audiobook narrator, we were talking about him earlier, has managed to like embody them just naturally. We did an event together that was really fun. Oh, I saw you.
Yeah, that's where we were. Yeah, you guys were up on stage there. It was great to hear you guys talk about it.
And Scott and I were doing, I was saying like, read this character. Like, it's, you know, it's like he's a, it's like a magic show. We keep talking about magic, but you know, you put in a quarter and he can do Joey, he can do Tommy, he can do Evan, he can do Mia, he can do Peter. He does all these voices. And he's captured it in a way that is distinctly his, but also the overlay, like our creative instincts are just so lined up that it's not like I hear Scott's voice, but whenever Scott does a character, it's like a creative evolution in his own voice of the character that I'm thinking of. And I think that's why the relationship works so well.
Yeah, it was amazing seeing him do that, because he became those characters on stage. And once again, it goes back to them being actors. It's not just them lending their voice. They're lending everything in their experience that has got them to that point to have your book in front of them and recording it right there. So what's it like to have your audiobook narrator, Scott Brick, have his own fandom within your audiobook? And Ray Porter narrates mine. He has his own fandom as well, which is something that I didn't know as I was starting down this path. But what's that like for you guys?
Well, I love it. I mean, I'm part of his fandom, so that helps. And Scott's also a friend. But what's, you know, Scott's got that, like, you know, the golden voice, right? He's just so cool. And so it's really funny because he'll come to my launch parties a lot. Sometimes they're on his birthday, like they coincide, and he'll show up and he'll be talking just to his, you know, girlfriend or friend. And people start to turn around, right, in the audience and be like, wait, I think that's Scott Brick. So I always give him a hard time that he just shows up and talks and steals all my thunder. You know, and then I go up and I have to like read a segment from the book. And it's always, you know, I always feel like I'm paling in comparison to him. But I love that part of it. And it's really fun for me. We overlap, you know, at events, as you know. I mean, you met him, I think, was that the first time? You might have met him another time, but it's cool to see people engage with that. And it's, you know, to have this sort of, extension of my world and have him bring all that skill and talent to it. It's cool. And then I love like when he talks and just seeing people orient, especially if we're at like, you know, book events or library stuff where people know that. I like watching the kind of heads alert and snap over. So it's cool. You know, he's a hell of a guy.
Yeah, no, he seemed great when I met him. Obviously, he's at the top of his game and is an amazing human. But it is cool to see people identify with the voice when they hear that voice, because like we talked about, audiobooks are that fastest growing segment of publishing. So there's so many people that just experience our work through someone else's voice, which is so fascinating. And it seems that Scott Brick has established an emotional connection to Orphan X world. And has that produced anything unexpected for you guys or made you think differently about your work?
Yeah, you know, there's times we've become, you know, I think the first book of mine he did was The Crime Writer in 2008. So we've been working together a long time, enough that we know some of the cadence of things that are even going on in our own personal lives. And so he'll read, like he just emailed me something I was working on and said, "Oh man, I read this and I remember you going through this thing right at that time, and that's in the writing." Like it's like an interesting thing having a relationship where we're friends enough to know kind of what's going on with each other, right? And then to see some of that reflected. And what's weird is, you know, there's some people that everyone has this. I mean, I have certain readers who just hit me emotionally when I read them. They have like all the keys to the locks, you know, and that's how we choose our favorite writers quite often. And for some reason, I feel so fortunate that, like, I think that my writing does that with Scott. Like he's emotional when we have emails about it. There's a lot of funny stuff about him being like, "Wait, what's this kid's song they're singing? And I can't sing. How am I supposed to sing it? I had to put my wife on the phone because I can't do it." He'll ask about how to pronounce certain things. And like, you know, a lot of wacky things come up that we're in touch over. But what's really nice is there's these moments where something just hits him, and when he has that emotional reaction, I can hear him embody that when he's reading the chapter. And that's really, those are the moments that are the most special to me.
Yep. And I think that goes for readers as well. I mean, that's why they connect with your novels, is because they have that emotional connection with the character. And that's what, that's that heart. That's that part that you can't really conceptualize. It's that intangible that makes something, turn something from a good work into a great work. It's that heart, that one intangible piece. And you've got it in your novels, and Scott does an amazing job bringing that up, because obviously he's feeling that as well. And in Dark Horse, you really up the stakes in terms of visceral action. The scenes will test the narrator. And I do think about that as I'm writing as well every now and again. I don't want to let my narrator off the hook with any of that. But some of those scenes can test the narrator. And are you testing Scott in some way? And are you using the audiobook to push the writing in any way? What's the relationship there?
I basically try to push myself as much as I can in each book. I try and do really different things and raise the bar. And I don't really feel like I'm doing my job in a book unless there's some part, usually that like the big fat second act of the book in the middle, where I feel like I've screwed it up and I can't do it. And I, you know, I've set the challenge kind of too high. And so, you know, in this book, there's a couple scenes, there's a lot of battlefield upgrade scenes. You know, there's one where Evan has to start and the only weapon he has his hands on is a pencil, and he has to upgrade from there. And then there's a later scene that he has to upgrade from a pen, and it goes all the way up the chain of how he takes over. I like to think about the action sequences as almost their own miniature three-act plays. You know, they all have to have their own emotion and turns, or else we're just reading kind of, you know, nonstop action. There's got to be some element to them that feels different. And so what's interesting is I'm not thinking about pushing Scott or the audiobook when I'm writing. But if I'm pushing myself, and if I'm figuring out different ways to write, I've had some chapters that are just all dialogue, for instance. I don't put anything else, but it's just like a dialogue exchange. Like, I'll start to play with stuff. And so I think that naturally, if I'm pushing myself, it should be moving Scott into new places, at least within Orphan X. He's got such a wealth of experience. I'm never worried he's going to be caught flat-footed or anything. But the books have different things and cadences and tones. And as I push into those, it's always interesting for me to see how he interprets them.
Yeah, that's interesting, because as I'm reading your book, Dark Horse in particular, I'm thinking, did he do this intentionally? Or is this just something that comes naturally? Because I find that a lot of when I do that, when I have a chapter that's mostly dialogue, it just came naturally that way. It wasn't, I didn't plan it that way. And when I have one that's almost no dialogue, I didn't plan it that way either. It just kind of happened. Is that natural for you? Or do you, when you are you going into a chapter thinking, okay, this one's going to be just dialogue?
I think it comes up, and then I realize, like, I don't won't even say he said, she said sometimes. Like, it's literally just a dialogue, like a play, you know? And if it can be clear, it's amazing. Yep. I always want to leave the reader to make as much of the connections themselves. You know, one of the things I think a lot about is one of my favorite films is The Sixth Sense. And there's this incredible moment in it where one of my favorite moment in the movie is when Cole's in the car with his mom, and her one like holy place in her life is her mom, who passed away, who she was very close to. And he's going through his whole "I see dead people" thing again, and she's upset. There's the biker with the whole thing. And he looks at her and he says, "I saw grandma the other day." And she just breaks down crying. Like, you know, the kid can be psychotic, but like, don't bring my mom into it. Right. And she says, just don't. And he says, you know, she came up and she says that you go to her grave every day and that you ask a question. And she said, the answer to the question is always. And he pauses and he goes, what's the question? And she just breaks down weeping. And she says, I asked her if she's proud of me. And it's this amazing moment for the first time where she knows and believes who he is. And one of the things that's so moving in that is if you reverse the order of it, right? And Cole says, hey, I saw grandma. She says that you go to her grave every day and ask if she's proud of you. And she wants to know the answer is always. There's no emotion. And part of what Knight did so brilliantly is in reversing the question and the answer, right? It actually pushes it internally into the viewer because they're doing the math on their own. And so it forces it to be an emotional experience because they're making the connection within themselves. And there's a lot of different devices. Stephen King's an expert at doing stuff where he drops something later that's a remembered horror, that the menacing piece comes at the end. Like, you know, that's the horror thing, right? The couple's making out in the forest, and then they hear a scratching noise, and they hear that a guy's escaped with a hook hand, and they drive away. And at the next stop, the hook hand is dangling from the doorknob, right? Times of menace, you know, remembered from a later time of relative tranquility is horrifying. So the ordering of information and what we leave out has as much effect as what the information is itself. And so a lot of what I'm trying to do in these chapters, and it does come naturally, it's not like this is a math equation that I can sit and plan in advance, but a lot of times I try and think about how do I lead the reader to the edge of an emotional experience and then have them do all the math themselves internally. Right? That's part of what I'm striving for. And so sometimes for that, it's like, let them figure out who's talking in the phone conversation, like let them construct all this. Right. And so it's something that I'm very conscious of, the ways that we have to trust the readers to bring their own, you know, hopes, dreams, shortcomings, fears, anxieties, neuroses to the table. You want to open up and leave room for it. And it's one of the reasons why I think my writing's gotten less graphic in some ways, but at times the suspense is more horrifying because I'll leave it off at a particular moment where it might be a lot more menacing if someone else fills it in with themselves.
Yep. No, exactly. Letting what you leave out is just as important as what you put in. And oftentimes I find myself having to be cognizant of this in that I'm so emotionally involved in the story because I'm there with it for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 months that I know it so well, but I have to take a step back sometimes and take a breath and say, oh, someone else is experiencing this one time for the first time. Am I expecting too much of them? So I do think of that from time to time. But to wrap this up, what is the hardest part of the life of a writer?
Well, somebody once said, being a writer means having homework for the rest of your life. And I think the hardest part for me is it's hard to turn. There's no divisions, right? Like, what's the division between your life and your training and your friendships in the military and what happens in your books, right? Like, what's your training with how you like your coffee and what's in your books, right? It's everywhere. It's all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So you're out with people. Somebody has a particular turn of phrase. Somebody has a telling moment or detail about them. You're always observing. And at times, I think it's challenging to not always be able to turn off that sort of observation filing mechanism of the brain. You know, it'd be nice to be able to just check that at the door once in a while. And so sometimes, you know, I'm drawn to stuff that's, you know, more extreme, right? Things that are more visceral. Like for me, it's funny because if I can't sleep at night, I'll watch like Silence of the Lambs and then I'll go to bed. Like I need something like riveting, right? Rather than something that's, and so a lot of times for me, that's like, you know, sports that might be more intense or like other activities that I have that really force me to be all the way present. And so that's a part of it that's challenging, but also it's like, what a great challenge to have that so much of myself is in my work, right? So everything, it's a blessing and a curse.
Exactly. I'm going to ask you more questions about that on the podcast. So if people want to know more about that, they can tune into our Danger Close podcast. But congratulations on Dark Horse. This is amazing. You crushed it again, raised the bar again. And thank you so much for spending a little time here. Audiobook, you and Scott, what a team. And I know you guys are going to rise right to the top of the list with this one once again.
All right. Thank you.
This is Scott Brick. We hope you've enjoyed Dark Horse, a Macmillan audio production from Minotaur Books. This title was produced by Guy Oldfield, recorded and engineered by Jeremy Wesley, post-production by Tim Franklin, text copyright 2022 by Greg Hurwitz, production copyright 2022 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.